to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Last week, we brought you the opening remarks from a compelling panel discussion at Concordia College featuring former North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp and former Governor Ed Schaefer. The event, titled With Malice Towards None, took place on April 3rd and explored how personal convictions and faith shape leadership in public service. Today, we delve deeper by airing significant portions of the Q&A session from that evening, providing a closer look at how these two leaders maintain their integrity and uphold principled commitments amid the complexities of political life. Join us as we uncover these personal reflections and discuss their wider impact on political conduct and leadership. The discussion was moderated by Dr. Nicholas Howard, Assistant Professor of Political Science, and Dr. Sonia Wentling, Dean of the School of Arts and Sciences, who posted the initial question about the moral compasses guiding Senator Heitkamp and Governor Schaefer.
Both of you were talking about good people needing to stand up. And Governor, you were talking about that you need to stay true to yourself. My question is somewhat of a personal nature. What informs your moral compass, your goodness? What has kept you on the good side to fight for the good people?
That's a great question, because I think it's one of the most important element of performance is knowing who you are, what you believe, what you stand for. Because as Governor Link told me, it's so easy to get pushed off by a poll or whatever. If you don't know what you stand for, if you don't know what you believe in, it's very difficult to walk a straight line and get it done. For me, I'm a Christian, I'm a follower of Jesus, and my moral compass and character comes from the Bible and the truths of the Bible. And I relate that to what I believe in and how, when I'm faced with a situation, when I have to make a decision, when I have to listen to somebody that disagrees or whatever, you know, I go back to the love and the compassion of Jesus, and that's what keeps me in the straight line.
I think it's interesting because I once did Girl State, and a young woman asked me during the program, she said, "You're Catholic, you were raised Catholic." I said, "Yes." "How do you square your political beliefs with your religion?" And I thought it was kind of a brash question, actually. And I said to her, I said, "I think I am who I am because of my religion. I was raised with a sense of service and commitment to each other." You know, when you look at kind of the tradition that you're raised in, the religious tradition that you're raised in, I think for me, it definitely informed my priorities and what I cared about. And I think when you're a politician and there is always a shortcut, trust me, there's always the easy way out of making a decision, especially if you're in the legislative branch. It's a little harder to hide the decision when you're an executive, but if you're in the legislative branch, you can always lay low and just go with the flow, right? And no one's gonna know who you are or what you've done. The bottom line is the votes that you take may not be the ones that you, the public, understand, but they are the ones that challenge you to live your faith, to live your ideals, to live your values against a big headwind of the people don't want you to do it. I would say the votes I'm proudest of are the ones that I felt took a principled position against a big headwind. The votes I'm least proud of are the ones where I copped out, where I took a dodge, where I took a fall, just so I didn't have to confront the tough decisions. You know, I said this morning on a radio show, I am not Saint Heidi. I've not done everything right. But I think at the end of the day, the most important thing that you can do, if you have made, and you know, by the way, you know when you've made one of those decisions because you don't feel very good about it. The thing that you can do in the spirit of Jesus, I think, is to step back and say, I did not do what I needed to do today. I will do better tomorrow. And we can all grow from the mistakes that we make, from the decisions that we didn't make, or the decisions that we made that were done for selfish purposes and not for purposes of advancing society in the long run.
I'm curious, for both of you having different backgrounds politically in terms of what offices you served in and how you got there, kind of, when you think about the world, what does it mean for a politician to serve and live in this increasingly polarized world we live in?
That was the second part.
I'll get there.
Do what every good politician does. Answer the question you wanted asked.
It was broad. It was broad for a reason.
Go ahead. Oh, I even forgot the question.
So what does it mean for a politician to live kind of in this polarized world?
You look at the people who have stood against the wave, stood for principles, and, you know, obviously you're all going to know who I'm talking about. People like Liz Cheney, that I would not have agreed with Liz Cheney in any way, shape, or form, but I believe she's a true patriot. Mitt Romney. But I want to mention a friend of mine, James Lankford. James Lankford and I are about as polar opposite. Other than having red hair, we have nothing in common. But we served, I was ranking member or committee chair, I can't remember which. I think it was one year I was chair and he was ranking, and the next it was reversed. But we did a lot of work together, and we built that mutual respect and a friendship. That was kind of really odd, given kind of where we came from. But I watched him stand in the void. And I think found his voice. And I thought, it doesn't matter whether you agree with what James did or not, whether you agreed. And you all know James Lankford was part of the chief negotiator on the immigration reform bill that was never taken up in the Senate. An unlikely hero standing in the void, a profile in courage. And so it used to be that you were in the political limelight and get accolades for being the compromiser, for being somebody who would put the tough work in, come up with a result that may not be perfect. And now, to be that person is the greatest risky place in politics. To be a compromiser is the greatest risky place in politics. And that makes this era of our political discourse that much harder, because you are not going to get anything done unless you're willing to compromise.
I'm not a compromiser. You know, how is it to work in the political system today? I love it. First of all, I'm a debater. I like talking to people with difference of opinion. I like gathering a lot of different, some people are a little weird out there these days, but I have this thing in me about, I want to wade into the conflict because I want to solve the conflict. Which is kind of dumb sometimes, because you can't solve the conflict. You know, I really enjoy it. And one of the reasons I enjoy it is because I've been blessed to be held in good stead in the state of North Dakota. So 25 years after we're out of office, people are still saying, you did a good job. What do you think about this? Takes us longer to go grocery shopping these days because everybody wants to talk about it. I think the important thing is going back to performance. You know, when you've done well, when people appreciate what you were able to accomplish, and maybe they even embellish it over time and think I did a better job than I did. The point is, I'm a people person. Politics is a people business. I love the interaction, and I actually enjoy getting yelled at once in a while. Not at home, but, you know, in the grocery store. But I do appreciate that conflict, because I really think, you know, that the more that people are willing to stand up and express their views in their direction, the better off, the better policy, the better direction that we're going to get, because you somehow, some way, incorporate what they say in what you do. And it may not be recognizable, it may not be, hey, you know, so-and-so told me that I should do this. But, you know, you gather that information, and the more information, the more feeling you get from people, the more you understand that there is difficulty and angst, and people are angry and difficult. But the more you can absorb that, the better job you're going to be able to do moving forward.
So ask for story time a little bit from each of you on your answers to the first part. What is a specific example in your careers of reaching across the divide, of actually working towards solving these problems in your specific examples?
Interestingly, one of the comments or interactions we had with the students today asked a similar question about, you know, or I guess when we were talking to the faculty, is how do you change your mind? Or, you know, is an institution here, the education and learning that allows me to change my mind, you know, to gather the information. One of the things I was talking about was there was a time when there was a difficult policy decision on the table. I think it was Heidi, I'm not sure, but, you know, we had to, you know, go into this meeting with a plan, with what we wanted the outcome to be. The staff was all tuned up. We had all the notes. Everything was there. And during this time of the meeting, I changed my mind because what was being said, the other side, the other thing that was going on, it was that, again, that experience with the staff, you know, was like, what are you doing? but it was that drawing of the information that said, okay, you know, maybe that is the best way to go. And again, it's the focus on not your political philosophy or your direction, but it's like, what's best for the people here? There was a time when I vetoed a piece of legislation. It became apparent afterward that was probably the wrong decision. And I actually wrote a letter to the legislators and said, override my veto, you know. You have to be willing out there to, you know, accept that information and do what's right. It was one of the tenets in our office was do the right thing, and we tried to do that as much as we could.
We are listening to excerpts from With Malice Towards None, a panel discussion held at Concordia College with former North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp and former Governor Ed Schaefer. The event was held on April 3rd.
And I think my whole history in the Senate is one of working across the aisle. You couldn't get anything done. Senate's a place where you need 60 votes. And if you're not crossing over to try and get somebody to agree with you, to work with you, you really aren't getting it done. But I think some of the things that you do that people don't see or never result in legislation. People always say, well, what's the one thing you could tell me about your work? Well, I'm a big believer that a lot of challenges families have and individuals have is related to adverse childhood experiences and childhood trauma. If you've studied childhood trauma, you know if you have four or more adverse childhood experiences, there's 10. But if your score is 4, your life expectancy is 20 years less than anyone else in the country. These are indicators that tell us whether you're going to have mental health challenges, whether you're going to have addiction challenges. And so I came to the Senate wanting to find solutions to problems, not just, you know, treat the symptoms, but what are the root causes of the challenges that people have and families have, particularly children. And I knew that if I started preaching adverse childhood experiences and childhood trauma, everybody'd go, yeah, yeah, whatever. And so what we did in my office is we put together a series of interventions and seminars, starting with staff, bringing in staff members, and we started, and maybe there were 30 people at the first one. By the time we finished bringing experts talking about this, we had over 150 staff people in the room, because word of mouth spread that this is pretty interesting stuff. Today, in legislation, it's not going to have my name on it, but pretty much every piece of mental health legislation, every piece of education legislation will have a component that deals with childhood trauma. Okay, what does that mean? It means we'll never know whether we'll see healthier children or whether we'll have better interventions. But it does mean that you can have an impact that goes beyond just one piece of legislation, one farm bill, one, you know, banking bill that opens up community bankers to more opportunities. I'd go through all that. But if you said, what's the one thing that I think, if I had to say, might have a lasting impact with absolutely no attribution ever for me, it's the work that we did on adverse childhood experiences and childhood trauma, because I think it's critical.
Compromise can bring good things about.
That's not a compromiser. Isn't that what you said?
To follow up on that?
Yeah. He's been out of politics longer than I have.
But here's my point. I don't think that you have to compromise to craft good public policy. And we always say you have to compromise. You have to do it. You know, after my first legislative session, in the signy die party, which is what everybody, you know, claps when it's all over, Republican legislators came up to me and said, you don't compromise on anything. I said, I compromise for not my values. I don't have to give up my values to understand what's best for the people. And so I'm willing to incorporate what's best for the people. I don't have to compromise my values, what I believe, what I care about. I don't have to give that up. But I can craft policy that is beneficial for the common good. And I think that makes a difference. And so it always bugs me when people say, well, you have to compromise. You don't. People say you have to be a moderate Republican.
Spoken like a governor.
Well, then let's not use the word compromise. But you do have to work together,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
To get things done. So what advice would you give our younger generation that maybe is interested, wants to go into politics, wants to do good? Should they stick to their principles? Should they compromise? What are your sort of recommendations, your guiding thoughts? What would you tell them?
I don't think when we talk about compromise, we talk about compromising principles or values. There's some things that you shouldn't compromise, you know, and you've got to know that as a politician. But the problem with politics today, and as a human being who has to look in the mirror in the morning after you take one of these votes, what I would say is, in America, we have let perfect be the enemy of good. By that I mean, we want what we want, and we want it the way we want it, and if it's not that way, I'm not going to do it. I wanted to do a bill that dealt with improving border security on the northern border. Everybody agreed with it. It was supposed to go through unanimous consent, and one person said, I'm not going to let that go, because one person can freeze you out from unanimous consent, and I'm not going to go with that because I want something for the southern border. I'm saying, I just want to do this one thing that's going to get us more border openings and more border patrol on the northern border, and everybody agrees that we need it. Perfect is the enemy of good. And if we're ever going to move policy along, I would tell young people, understand your values. Yes, be true, like Ed said, to who you are as a person, and know that if you do something that makes you feel internally bad, is probably you're compromising a core value. But you aren't going to get the whole loaf. That's not the way the world works. Certainly not the way legislation works. And so find those victories, because incrementally things can improve. And if you aren't willing to do incremental improvement, we're going to stall out the way we've been stalling out in Washington right now.
Advice to young people today is really to understand that our system is great, that our system works. And while it's difficult sometimes and man, it gets nasty, and there's a lot of pushback or whatever. You know, we have a political system in the United States of America that is solid, it's good, it's resilient, and it survives. And we have elections, and they change, and everybody thinks, oh, I'm so important, I'm going to change the world when I get elected, and then they don't do it. But you know what? Our system survives. We often, and especially students and young people today, you know, think it's all about me, it's so important, I have to get in there, I have to get it done, I have to have my voice be heard. And when you do that, I think you really get to the point of saying, like I said, it's all about me and not about the people. So my advice is always take the stance that you have to represent all the people all the time. If you're going to serve, you need to serve people, not the government, not your own political party. You need to serve the people. In doing that, when we talk to campus leaders here today, they're involved, there are various factions on the campus, there are other people, and Heidi's advice was, hey, go stand next to them. The people you disagree with, the people you don't understand, be there, engage, learn from them. But here's the reality, they have their opinion, they arrive there through study, through education, through prayer, and it's real and right for them. It might be different than yours, but that doesn't make it wrong. And we need to have that understanding between people to make the system work.
We're starting to learn who the candidates are for the 2024 election. For the presidential race, we know now. And we're starting to learn, we're going to learn soon, for the North Dakota gubernatorial race, for the House race to replace the aspiring gubernatorial candidate in Kelly Armstrong and other races. I'm curious how you see kind of the, I'm going to say stakes, because I can't come up with a better word, of this election. It doesn't have to be presidential. It can be congressional. It can be state level. Essentially, kind of how do you see this race in isolation for the stakes of it and kind of the history leading to this?
You know, in the governor's race specifically, what I'm interested in the governor's race and what the results are is I'm interested in both candidates saying, this is how I'm going to govern. And let me give you an example. Both are Republican gubernatorial candidates in North Dakota. Both of them, when they made the announcement, said, I'm going to follow along with Governor Burgum's effort to eliminate the income tax. So as I've been interacting and talking to both candidates, you know, my question is, what's your tax policy? What's best for the people of North Dakota? I want to know how you're going to govern. And if you're going to walk into that governor's office with a preconceived notion of what you're going to do already, you can't represent the people. The example that I talk to them about is when you say you're going to lower or you're going to eliminate the income tax in North Dakota. I go, okay, so 60% of the people in North Dakota don't pay income tax. The high-level earners pay income tax. You know, eliminating the income tax sounds good to Wall Street and billionaires and things like that. But what about the people? Now, if you're going to have tax policy for the people, and by the way, tax policy isn't revenue. By the way, tax policy is behavior. And if you're going to have tax policy for the people, maybe eliminate sales tax on clothing, you know, or something like that, that benefits everybody in the state instead of a little bit. And I think that's the difference when you get in the chair of governor, you're representing all the people all the time, and you got to have that different perspective of being able to absorb what people are needing and looking for and wanting in their government and reacting to that and developing public policy to do that. So that's what I'm looking for in the governor's race.
The unfortunate thing is that this is not going to be a campaign of inspiration. My hopes and my dreams is that we are inspired to vote for someone. And what you're going to hear, I don't care if it's Democrat or Republican, what you're going to hear is be very afraid of the other person. The other person's really a bad person. The other person will do really bad things. And that is going up and down the ballot. And you see it right now in the governor's race, right? I mean, there isn't any policy difference, so I don't know what all of the negative ads are. Just seems to me like that kind of fear or that kind of negative stuff is even infiltrating in a primary race in North Dakota in the dominant Republican Party. And so what I would say is that if you're looking for an inspiring, uplifting, boy, am I excited about America Democracy 2024, you should maybe go to sleep because it's not going to happen. And so the question becomes, in this cycle, do we just let that wash over us and say we're going to try and be better?
Those were excerpts from the With Malice Towards None panel discussion held at Concordia College featuring North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp and former Governor Ed Schaefer. Both leaders shared profound insights on how personal values and faith shaped their political leadership. They discussed the challenges of maintaining integrity within a polarized environment and emphasized the importance of steadfastly adhering to one's belief amidst complex political decision-making. Their narratives highlighted the crucial role that ethical foundations play in guiding their actions and decisions in public service. Stay tuned for more segments from this enlightening panel discussion on future episodes of Main Street. Up next, the news.
Want to improve your relationships with colleagues, clients, and even neighbors? Experience the theory of enchantment with entrepreneur Chloe Valderi. Through film, music, and literature, learn how to embrace and create a more open-minded workplace, neighborhood, and community. Join Chloe Valderi and Humanities North Dakota on April 18th in Fargo. Get ready to level up your connections. More information online at humanitiesnd.org.
Debate season is here. and Prairie Public will host a pretty big one for this part of the world. It's the Republican primary contest for governor of North Dakota. I'm Dave Thompson. Join me and the candidates, Congressman Kelly Armstrong and Lieutenant Governor Tammy Miller, Tuesday, April 23rd at 7 p.m. Central, 6 p.m. Mountain. You can listen on a radio, a smart speaker or app, watch Prairie Public television service, or stream online at prairiepublic.org. Prairie Public's Election 2024 coverage is made possible in part by AARP North Dakota.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. For the nearly 117,000 students in North Dakota's public schools, it's reported that between 30 to 50% of their daily calories come from meals they eat at school. Those meals will become even healthier thanks to changes proposed by the USDA and the support available to help with implementation, particularly in rural districts. And every 5 years, the federal government publishes the Dietary Guidelines for Americans, which are expert nutrition recommendations for the nation based on the best scientific evidence. Currently, school nutrition standards do not align with these guidelines, so the USDA proposed revisions to improve the meals served to America's and North Dakota's school children. Here to discuss is Megan Maroney. She's from the Center for Science in the Public Interest, and she leads CSPI's Federal Child Nutrition Program initiatives and advocates for science-based policies to ensure every child has access to nutritious, delicious foods that support their health. And also joining us is Emily Carl. She formerly worked with the Grand Forks Public Schools and now consults working on projects for the State Department of Public Instruction. Megan, welcome to Main Street. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Emily, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
What we're talking about today are new requirements that are coming down for lunches that our students eat in our public schools. I'm curious, and maybe Emily, this might be a question for you first. What percentage of North Dakota students actually have at least one meal a day at school, or even two meals a day at school?
So North Dakota students on average are having breakfast and lunch at school at a rate of about 25% for breakfast, and 75 to 80% of our students are consuming lunch at school.
Is that about what it is nationally? Are those trends about the same?
In my experience, it's about the same. When I'm a former food service director, and when I was actively in that job, those were the rates that we were experiencing. And with conversations with other colleagues, I do feel that's pretty accurate across the board.
And now every 5 years, the federal government publishes Dietary Guidelines for Americans. And this now has impacted rules that will be promulgated for students and their lunches that they have at public schools. Megan, what new changes should we anticipate, and how will they affect school lunch programs?
Sure. So USDA has proposed the first ever added sugars limit on school meals, and that looks like no more than 10% of calories from added sugars over the week will be allowed to come from added sugars. And also they're proposing caps on some of the most sugary products in school meals, like cereal, yogurt, and breakfast breads. This is really important because 9 out of 10 schools currently exceed the dietary guidelines limits for added sugars for breakfast, and nearly 7 out of 10 schools are exceeding a safe limit for lunch. So an added sugars standard for school meals is long overdue. There's also gradual sodium reduction limits that have been proposed. Overall, a total of about a 30% reduction in sodium at lunch and 20% reduction at breakfast. USDA has solicited comments on two alternatives for milk, the first one being limiting flavored milk to only grades 9 through 12, or continuing to allow flavored milk in all grades, but requiring that all flavored milk meets an added sugars cap. And lastly, there is a proposal on whole grains to require that at least 80% of the grains offered per week in the school lunch and breakfast programs are whole grain rich.
Emily, what do these new rules and guidelines, how will they impact people that are on the front lines of serving meals to North Dakota students?
Yeah, these guidelines are definitely a step in the whole process continuing to get closer to meeting those dietary guidelines for Americans. It will impact how food is coming into our schools. We'll need to work with manufacturers and distributors to make sure that the foods that they're making for our programs do meet these requirements set by USDA. So that could take some time. Luckily, within the timeline of these proposed changes, there is some wiggle room and some catch-up time for all of that to kind of take place. And really, our students won't see much of an impact. As Megan said, a lot of these changes are gradual changes, so it will just feel like a natural change over time.
Megan, your role is to advocate for science-based policies. Do these new guidelines hit the mark, or is there still more work to do, and what might that work be?
They're a really critical step in the right direction. I will say, long-term, we will need to continue to keep working on sodium reduction to get school meals in full alignment with the dietary guidelines. But honestly, children's sodium consumption, and for that, along those same lines, everyone, pretty much everyone in the U.S. sodium consumption is so far away from the recommendations. These changes will be really a really big deal for school meals. So I think right now we're really excited to see them being as strong as they are. And then, you know, in 10, 15 years down the line, we can talk about what needs to happen next.
Emily touched on this, Megan. From your perspective, what resources do schools need to have from perhaps the federal government or others to meet these standards?
Sure. Well, USDA knew that schools were going to need a lot of support in meeting these standards. So they recently launched a $100 million initiative called the Healthy Meals Initiative, aimed at helping schools improve the nutritional quality of their school meals. And through this effort, there are numerous grant opportunities to help schools connect with local food providers, upgrade their facilities, hire staff, and connect with other school food professionals and receive national recognition for their work. In addition to this, Congress can help out by putting more funds towards technical assistance and training opportunities for schools and increasing the reimbursement rate for school meals. So this is an all hands on deck effort, but with a lot of support both at the federal level as well as the state and local level, we can do this.
How do students usually receive these changes relative to their school lunch programs sometimes? And erroneously, I'll add, maybe they think, these healthy things just aren't as good tasting as the stuff we used to get, so I'm not going to participate, or the parents might have that perception. How do we work with that?
From the school aspect, with these changes that are coming, it'll be really important to be on the front end of it and looking at recipes and the food items that, you know, are sold at a really high level, and working on tweaking those now and doing taste testings with students and getting that feedback to see what's working and what's not working and where those tweaks and changes can happen, and getting those students and parents as appropriate at the table to have that conversation and to be choosing what food items are eventually on their menu. I think that helps with these changes and kind of takes away that, like, oh, yuck, it's healthy. I automatically don't like it.
We're enjoying our conversation with Megan Maroney. She's from the Center for Science in the Public Interest. Megan leads CSPI's Federal Child Nutrition Program initiatives. And also with Emily Carl. She formerly worked with the Grand Forks Public Schools, and she now consults and works on projects with the Department of Public Instruction. How do these guidelines impact the desire to purchase locally and to source locally? Do we know?
Sure. You know, we see, again, I want to point back to the Healthy Meals Incentive Initiative. There's a lot of effort going into improving connections with local food systems at the federal level. You know, these federal funds can help local school districts connect with, you know, the farmer down the street or the food producer down the street. There's a lot of purchasing from large national corporations in the school meals program, but I think we're seeing more and more of these connections being made at the local level, farm to school programs that are connecting kids with the food that is grown in their town. So I think we're making a lot of progress there. And, you know, when you're able to have a relationship with a local food producer, you're able to have those conversations about, you know, hey, I really, you know, need to work on the added sugars in this product. Is there anything we can do to make it a little bit, have a little bit less sugar in it? Conversations that you might, you know, not be able to have with a large national producer.
Emily, how would this impact you locally working here in North Dakota?
The Local Foods Initiative is a big push in North Dakota. We have a lot of agricultural resources. And so anytime that we're able to connect with a local grower or a local producer, you know, that school is just able to get that food at a fresher and higher quality where it hasn't had to go through any processing to be able to withstand transportation, storage, things like that. So particularly when we're talking about sodium, that's one big, really big way that we can reduce sodium is looking at geographically closer food systems to bring into our schools.
Generally speaking, do we know, are more kids coming back, so to speak, to school lunches? Are fewer kids participating in the programs? First, locally here in North Dakota, and maybe Megan, then you can offer something from a national perspective. Emily?
I haven't seen a huge difference from my time in Grand Forks till now. However, that space during the pandemic, when we were able to provide lunches at no cost, we did see an increase in participation during that time.
Megan, from a federal perspective?
I think that really mirrors the federal perspective as well. I will add that several states have continued to offer free meals for all students, and those states are experiencing, you know, a continuation of that increase in participation. But I think we're largely back to pre-pandemic levels in participation.
Emily, I want to visit with you a little more about this subject. You wrote a letter to the North Dakota legislature at one time, pre-pandemic, saying, you know, it's not a great idea to provide free lunches for all. We should just consider those who qualify for free and reduced lunches. But now your opinion's different.
Yes, it is. So several years ago, when the topic of free meals first came up, it was pre-pandemic. And as a food service director, you know, I really took it from that lens of the administrative burden and the paperwork burden and kind of what it would look like, what the system would look like and how that would work. And so at that time, I had concerns that way that it would, you know, essentially upset the apple cart and not work out the way that it was intended and there would be unintended consequences, so on and so forth. Then fast forward several months and we were put into the pandemic where all meals were available at no cost. And we were able to almost practice what that would look like. And it was really successful. And we really saw our impact from our food distribution, the way that we did that, and our participation increased. And it really ended up being a positive thing. And now I just feel like school lunches should just be considered part of the school day, just like your science textbook is considered part of the school day. And students should be able to have a healthy school lunch at no cost to them or their families.
What do we know about the importance of good nutrition and performance in the classroom? Do either of you look at that kind of data?
We know that attendance in school meals program are associated with better attendance, better behavior, and academic performance. And, you know, consuming a healthy diet and offering meals that meet science-based limits on added sugars and sodium will help protect kids against adverse health outcomes like high blood pressure, heart disease, dental caries, and cancer. So, you know, it's just so important to meet kids where they are most of their day at school with healthy meals and, you know, setting them up for lifelong healthy eating habits. We can introduce new foods to them in the cafeteria and have them bring that home and tell their parents, hey, guess what I tried today? And, you know, really support families in that way as well. And, you know, those impacts can really spread throughout the community.
We have just a few moments left in our discussion. What about summertime meals for kids? Will these guidelines impact them ultimately as well?
I can speak to that. They will not, unfortunately. Summer meals can be offered under two different programs. The Seamless Summer option is part of the National School Lunch Program, and those meals would still be required to meet these guidelines. But I think the majority of summer meals that we see are offered under the Summer Food Service Program, which has different and I would say markedly weaker school nutrition standards than the ones that we see during the school year.
Emily, any last comments you'd like to share?
I think the changes that are coming are just a positive thing and will just help our nation provide nutritious meals to help our future leaders grow into the roles that they will take as they grow into adulthood.
That's Emily Carl. She formerly worked with the Grand Forks Public Schools and now consults working on projects with the State Department of Public Instruction. Emily, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Also with us today was Megan Maroney. She is employed by the Center for Science in the Public Interest. She leads CSPI's Federal Child Nutrition Programs initiatives and advocates for science-based policies to ensure every child has access to nutritious, delicious foods that support their health. Megan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Tom Ezern is next with a Plains Folk essay. Stay with us.
Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds. And by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally, working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages.
Tom Ezern's Plains Folk essay offers a poignant glimpse into a unique tradition of early 20th century America, the book shower. Focusing on the communal spirit of the small town of Canton, South Dakota, Ezern recounts an intriguing episode from 1913 when a newly established library found itself without a single book. In a remarkable display of community support and generosity, residents flooded the new building, each bearing books to stock the empty shelves. This act not only filled the library, but also symbolized the unity and cultural aspirations of a community poised to shape its own destiny.
By the action of a local donor, the town of Canton, South Dakota, had a new public library in 1913. They had the building, but unfortunately no books. The night of its opening, however, they turned on the lights, and as reported in the local press, the public came in throngs, all bearing books, books of every description. It was a book shower, a common sort of event in the early progressive years of the 20th century, but something I never heard of until the South Dakota Historical Society recently sent out a historical feature about the bookish night in Canton. It was gratifying to read about, even more so to experience, as a local poet testified. And out of the house the books came tumbling. Great books, small books, fat books, brawny books, black books, red books, blue books, snowy books. Families by tens and dozens. The poet made the occasion into a celebration of community. The books were a metaphor representing the good citizens of a young community coming into its own. From far places, in all their diversity, they came together as families, came together to form something larger by civic action. Investigating, I find that the book shower was not a singular event. It happened all over North Dakota and in the other commonwealths of the Great Plains. There came a time in our little pop-up railroad towns that people wanted a real library with real books. This was a second-generation phenomenon, an emergence from the children of the pioneers. Donors, well, often Andrew Carnegie, through his famous program of assistance to public libraries, secured a building. Then they announced a book shower. By they, I mean the women of the community. The cultivation of public libraries in the progressive era was a feminine function. It came out of women's organizations, especially study clubs, those little society affairs where townswomen gathered to pour tea for one another and discuss matters of culture, especially books. In the early 1900s, these organizations stirred themselves to civic improvements, such as libraries, and they did so in a woman's way. There was a custom in the land of adapting the bridal shower into a book shower, so that book-loving brides could begin their households with a shelf of books, each one inscribed by a friend with thoughtful best wishes. This model of starting off a household on the right foot was scalable, women realized, and so emerged the book shower as a founding ritual for public libraries. The Pembina Express described the bridal book shower in 1913. A friend would scout the book collection of the prospective bride and apprise her circle what works were needed or desired. Givers secured the books, inscribed them thoughtfully, and showered them on the bride. When the book shower scaled up from a family event into a community enterprise led by the women, it was a sign of something good. The pioneers had grit and game. They built homes and businesses, but they also got up homegrown plays, baseball clubs, and cornet bands. The children of the pioneers took things to a new level of lasting benefit. This common impulse for the public good, manifest in one community after another, is a great story to tell, maybe one we need to hear.
That's Tom Easern with his Plains Folk Essays. Tom is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. More Main Street is ahead.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 16th. Before the railroad ran to Reynolds, North Dakota, steamboats brought the mail and supplies to nearby Frog Point. Residents traveled there by wagon to deliver their crops for shipping and to pick up supplies and mail. When the railroad arrived, an organized community began to take shape. Roads were laid out. Sidewalks were built of pine boards. A town government was organized. Reynolds ran into a snag in 1907 when it came to electing a mayor. The candidates were D.J. Hennessy and Dr. James Halliday, the incumbent. It was not a friendly contest. Supporters of Halliday insisted there was a problem with Hennessy's residential status. They said he voted in a different township in the previous election and hadn't become a legal resident of Reynolds until after the primary election, making him ineligible. On this date in 1907, the entire state was buzzing about the results of this election for a small-town mayor. Adding to the controversy over Hennessy's residence, the matter was further complicated when the votes were counted. With 44 votes for each candidate, they had tied. The town council planned a meeting to decide how to proceed. For his part, Halliday said he would not give up the office of mayor until he had to. When the city council met, the members agreed to seek the opinion of the state's attorney. Halliday supporters continued to argue that Hennessy wasn't qualified to run for office. In the end, the matter was decided by a silver dollar. The council summoned both candidates to a meeting. The president of the council took the coin from his pocket. As he tossed it, Hennessy called out, "Heads." The coin landed on the floor, and after rolling around a bit, ended heads up. Halliday objected to determining an election by the toss of a coin. He said he would contest the matter in the courts. However, he eventually gave up, and Hennessy became the mayor. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
It's something that no other affluent nation is facing. In the U.S., gun violence is the number one cause of death for children and adolescents. In part three of our series on guns in America, we hear from young people about their experiences with gun violence.
I got into a little fight, and that's when I put out my gun. I ain't wanna shoot nobody.
That story on the next morning edition from NPR News.
4 a.m. Central to 9 a.m. Central, here on Prairie Public.
In part three of our series on guns in America, we hear from young people in Pennsylvania about their experiences with gun violence. That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
4 a.m. Central to 9 a.m. Central, here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you have been with us. My co-host Ashley Thornburg joins me in our Fargo studios. Hey, Ashley.
Hello.
We have an interesting show for our listeners tomorrow.
Tomorrow is Assistive Technology Awareness Day. Did you know? Do you even know what assistive technology means?
I could guess about assistive technology, but I did not know it was Assistive Technology Day.
Well, you know, you might think of something like a smart home. Alexa, turn on the lights. Sorry to everyone whose lights I just turned on.
Probably my own.
You know, think about a teenager who wants to fit in, but maybe has a condition where dexterity in the fingers just isn't quite there. Can't wear the cool shirts that the kids are wearing. And so has magnets instead of buttons and gets to dress just like all of the other kids. So we get a little tour of the North Dakota Assistive Technology Warehouse, a kind of a lending library of sorts.
Where is that?
There's one in Bismarck and one in Fargo.
Very cool.
Yeah. And later this evening, we are going to Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That's at 8 o'clock Central. She visits with a man who led the team mapping the human genome, answering questions like, how much can we blame DNA for depression and anxiety? Well, that's the $64 million question.
Sure is. Very interesting genetics.
Yes, it really is. I look forward to hearing that myself. And our thanks to our listeners for tuning in. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Enjoy the rest of your day.